Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Are you addicted to caffeine? You might not be if you had to spend this much on your morning Java.
$34.
Yikes, that's Leslie Parrish with this week's Marketplace Money Inside Quote, and that price is for one cup of coffee.
$34.
How could you possibly pay that much for a cup of Joe? Is the answer A, by buying it with a debit card and overdrawing your account? You could get dinged with a 34-buck fee. Or is the cause B, the declining dollar? In Singapore, 34 greenbacks is just enough for a cup of Sumatran blend these days. Or maybe it costs 34 bucks for C, Starbucks' latest beverage. It's called a Stockachino, and it comes with a share of the company. Only one answer is true. You'll find out which one on this week's Marketplace Money. It's coming up from American Public Media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money.
Taking a stand can be expensive. Just ask anyone who's ever walked a picket line. How do you prepare when you don't know how long you'll be out? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
The first nationwide strike against General Motors in 37 years came and went during the past week. 73,000 members of the United Auto Workers Union walked off the job Monday morning. They were back by Wednesday, but not before they had to go through plenty of stress over how they would pay their bills. Experts say walkouts are rare, but they do still happen. TV writers, for example, are holding their breath over a possible strike a month from now. So how do workers deal with the financial setback that inevitably comes with solidarity? Marketplace's Bob Moon has been looking into that.
We are the union.
We are the union.
The mighty, mighty union.
The mighty, mighty union.
It turned out they only had to hold out for a couple of days, but early on, some striking GM workers admitted to fears it might be a long strike, even while they were talking tough.
You know, I'll do what I have to do to have a good contract. You got to do what you got to do. And this is what it comes down to being a UAW member. You know, all of us sticking together.
Mighty, mighty union.
The mighty, mighty union.
Although the UAW is not as mighty as it once was, it still stood ready with a $900 million war chest that would have provided workers with $200 a week. Few unions can offer that kind of support, though, and how mighty they really are comes down to the spending power of their individual members.
We are forced back to work because we no longer can sustain the loss of salary and a looming end to our health care coverage.
A few weeks ago, clerical workers at the University of Minnesota went on strike for a couple of weeks, costing the average worker around $1,800 in wages. In the end, union leaders accepted the school's original settlement offer of an extra $300 a year.
Our members went into the strike under terrible financial hardship, and we were not prepared to have them endure anymore.
A strike is always difficult for workers, even when they prepare.
Professor Harley Shaken is an expert in labor issues at the University of California at Berkeley. He says even those workers lucky enough to get a few hundred dollars a week from their union can quickly face financial disaster. But particularly in communities hit with a major walkout, he says, the limited union support often comes with other lifelines.
It's meant as the core of larger packages that are often put together with donations, say, of food or suspensions of payments by local institutions. All this comes together to try to keep people whole during the strike.
Some unions or employers will keep paying for health coverage, but some don't. Some states offer unemployment benefits, but most don't. It can help to reduce the amount of cash that needs to go out to pay car loans or credit card bills, for example. Shaken says lenders can be especially understanding about a strike if they want to keep your business when you go back to work.
No retailer wants to be known as the person that came out against strikers when they were most vulnerable.
As the UAW strike began, Detroit area financial planner George Wells heard from clients wondering how to handle a sudden loss of income, some living paycheck to paycheck. He suggests borrowing from credit lines that will be least expensive down the road. That means avoiding the temptation to ring up credit card debt, but it also means being realistic about your ability to pay.
You can tap into your 401ks and take a loan. You do have to pay yourself back interest, but the problem is if you're not putting money in and additionally taking money out, you know, you're really not preparing yourself for the future.
In other words, there's no easy answer. As Wells sees it, the best solution starts long before a strike.
People that live right at their means or live beyond their means, you know, these are the times when you kind of get caught or you kind of get in trouble and you have to really figure out an escape plan in this type of crisis, that if you were saving properly, then you really don't find yourself in that position, because even if you're out of income for 5 or 6 months, you're still in a position where you're able to weather that type of storm.
In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
I understand when I give the bank my money, they're providing me with a service and they get to charge me for it. But how much and how often? Case in point, all those fees. Am I the only one who thinks they're getting a little bit excessive? Clearly not. A new study by the Center for Responsible Lending says we pay more than $17 billion a year in overdraft fees, and 18 to 24-year-olds pay a good chunk of that. Leslie Parrish co-authored this study. And Leslie, how does this happen?
So if you're going to, let's say, a coffee shop to buy a $2 coffee and you put it on your debit card, but you don't actually have enough money in your account, The bank will approve that transaction but charge you a fee of $34. So that cup of coffee just costs you a total of $36.
Yikes, that is one expensive cup of coffee. This obviously isn't a problem that's unique to young adults, but why are they, you know, going out and really not paying attention to the fact that they're going to get these overdraft charges?
Well, banking overdraft policies have changed a lot even over the last few years. It used to be that if you made a purchase but you didn't have enough in your account, your debit card would simply be declined and you would pay in cash or another form of payment. Now banks routinely cover these debit card transactions. And when you see that your debit card transaction has been approved, you likely think that you do have enough in your account.
Well, then what about the simple lesson of learn how to balance your checkbook?
Sure. And we definitely recommend that, you know, all adults keep a really close eye on their account balances. But we feel that banks should be a partner in those efforts and not stack the deck against them, which we think is happening now. And I'll just give two examples of that. Banks reorder debits and checks to clear the highest amount first, and that maximizes the overdraft fees that they can take in.
Can you explain that further for us?
Sure. So let's say you have $100 in your account and you've got three debits. You've got a $90 debit and two $15 debits. Well, you could take out the two $15 debits first, and then the $90 debit would result in one $34 overdraft fee. But if you rank them from high to low, that $90 debit comes out first, and then those two $15 debits cause two overdraft fees. You're doubling the amount of overdraft fees being charged to a young adult.
Okay, and you said there was a second issue?
Yes. So the second issue is banks will withdraw money from your account extremely quickly. However, when you're depositing money in your account, even if you're depositing it at your bank's own ATM, the bank can hold that for a significant period of time. Those laws regarding deposits haven't been updated in 20 years.
So what are you looking for? You were on the Hill this past week. What were you petitioning members of Congress to do?
There was a bill, H.R. 946, and what this bill would do is essentially provide consumers with a choice of a range of overdraft protection options. Right now, account holders, when they open their checking account, are automatically enrolled into the bank's highest cost overdraft loan program, and that is this $34 per transaction fee that I'm talking about, rather than lower cost line of credit programs, a linked credit card, or a linked savings account. So what the bill would do is not allow that automatic enrollment, but actually give customers a moment of choice where they can opt in to any or none of the overdraft protection options that the bank has.
Why would you want to opt out of overdraft protection?
If you did not have any form of overdraft protection on your account, if you did take your debit card and use it at a merchant, your debit card would simply be declined and you would not be charged a fee. So you're basically going back to what banks routinely did 3 to 5 years ago.
All right. Leslie Parrish is a senior researcher at the Center for Responsible Lending. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Okay, as many of you know, I've been carrying my trash around with me for the last 2 weeks. The point? To illustrate the problems and joys of cutting down on consumption in our consumer-driven economy. Wait, did I say joys? Well, I've now officially run out of trash jokes. What started off as a fun gag literally found me gagging earlier this week. There was a chicken carcass in my trash bag, mingled with some Windex-soaked rags. I'd give you more details, but I can't remember, and I don't have it with me anymore. I tossed it on day 10, Tuesday. Call me a gutless wonder. My work colleagues and husband call me savior. Other folks did join me, and I wondered how they fared. Beth Terry lives in Oakland. Looks like she's going to make it. She wisely limited the stinky stuff. In her bag, tape, a plastic wine cork, an unrecyclable cake container, cheese packaging, eyedrop containers.
It's teaching me to be very aware of not just what I throw away, but what I purchase in the first place, and to think about the whole life cycle of anything that I buy.
You do have to really make choices.
Right.
I have found that getting down to zero is practically impossible.
I think it probably is, but I don't know that I want to, because some things are, you know, you've got to have some luxuries. I love cheese, and you can't buy cheese without plastic wrap on it.
In fact, there's a lot of stuff on the shelves out there that you can't buy without extraneous packaging. Michelle Martinez of Stamford, Connecticut, found that the first few days of the challenge were tough. She had to remember to bring to work her own plates and cloth napkins from home. Her heaviest trash bag item? Catalogs. Her local sanitation district doesn't recycle them. Michelle also caught a cold during the challenge, hopefully not because of it. And although she flushed her tissues, she is still carrying the wrappers from cough lozenges. Final lessons?
Number one, appreciating kind of the convenience of the life that we have. But secondly, recognizing that a lot of times the convenience isn't necessarily worth it. The realization that if I make small adjustments, I can significantly reduce my trash. I do hope to keep it up in the long run.
So do I. And in a few weeks, we'll be devoting an entire program to the question, what's wrong with trash? It's part of a series of reports across American Public Media programs dealing with whether our consumer economy is sustainable. You can find out more by going to our website and clicking on the link that says sustainability. You can also get details of our 2-week trash challenge and find all kinds of great ideas for reducing what and how much you're sending to landfills, including one suggestion that we all buy pet rats. They eat chicken bones. He disarms bombs for a living, but what he really fears is the ticking time bomb of college tuition. Chris counsels a Navy dad. And we meet the most popular guy in Washington, D.C.
I'm on a first-name basis with secretaries of state, congressmen, senators, former and active.
A day in the work life of a hotel doorman. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Veglund. Presidential candidates faced off this week at debates in New Hampshire and Baltimore. Each hopes to occupy the White House in 2009. As veterans of the political wars, they also know some of the most important wheeling and dealing doesn't happen on Pennsylvania Avenue or at the Capitol building. It's at another landmark just down the street. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we meet the guy at the front door.
When I'm at an social setting and people ask me what my profession is, I tell them I'm the doorman at the Willard, because people who are familiar with the Willard being the most historical hotel in Washington, one block from the White House, now they know. They want stories. They want to hear, what famous people have you waited on? My name is Stephen Blum. I'm currently employed in my 21st year here at the Willard. Not too many people could say that they've waited on and shook hands with six U.S. presidents. I'm on a first-name basis with secretaries of state, congressmen, senators, former and active, even one who's running for president today, Mrs. Clinton. One time she's come to visit and make a speech here, and it was cherry blossom time in April, and we were giving out these cherry blossom pins that you could wear on your lapel. So when she arrived, I shook her hand and gave her her lapel button. And she gave me a kiss on the cheek. And now every time Mrs. Clinton comes to the hotel and she sees me, she waves and gives me a kiss on the cheek. To me, you know, that's something that I'm really proud of. I love the fact that I'm part of history here at the Willard. One of the challenges working outdoors is the weather. In the wintertime with the freezing cold, you know, it's difficult to wear gloves when you're outside giving out tickets and accepting money and tips and things like that. So the weather is a challenge. Rainy days, it sounds like something you would never really think about. But you ever try to hold an umbrella for somebody and take three bags and give them a ticket at the same time? It's not easy. And the most thing, they, especially the women getting out, they want the umbrella. A doorman's income is basically 80% gratuity. My annual salary might only show, if I don't include my tips, $25,000, $30,000, but I can make up to $80,000 or $90,000 a year in tips alone. People ask me what the biggest tip is that I ever received, and it was several years ago. We had a head of state, Queen of Thailand to be exact, and on the day of her departure, she invited several employees to come with a private audience with the Queen, and she handed me an envelope. The envelope was worth something. It was beautiful. It was fabric. It was so good. And I'll admit I was curious. By the time I got out of the elevator, I tore up the envelope, and it was $1,000. I did take part of the rest of the day off for that. My job keeps me physically fit. Well, I think one time we estimated how many bags we carry in the course of a day, and I've carried tons and tons of luggage in my life. And then one time we did a little survey with a pedometer and averaged out how much we walk in the course of a day. And the doorman came to like 11.4 miles per day. And if I take that over my 21-year career, I've walked around the world twice.
A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. We've got a photo of Mr. Blum and an archive of Day in the Work Life segments, as well as anything else you want to know about Marketplace Money, on our website. Go to marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
Net revenues bring us this week's Marketplace Money buzzword, Internet tax. Between spam and pop-ups, there's a lot to gripe about the internet, but at least you're not paying taxes for it yet. Thanks to a federal ban, net access is tax-free. But the ban ends November 1st, leading many to wonder if the World Wide Web will become the worldwide nickel and dimed, because some politicians think the net's an unexplored universe of revenue. Congress hasn't decided the future of internet tax, but perhaps you should prepare yourself for a computer greeting besides...
You've got mail.
Like maybe.
Got a box full of letters. Think you might like to read.
Well, we don't have a box full of letters, unless you're talking about the Marketplace Money email inbox. If that's the case, we're chock full of great questions But before we get to them, allow me to welcome our very own economics expert, Chris Farrell. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing well. And I just have to say, I really do love reading those emails. So, you know, send us more because they're great to go through.
Absolutely. And the way you do that is by taking down our website address. It's marketplace.org. Click on the contact button there. Or if you like, you can give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we spell that M-O-N-Y. All right, let's go to caller number one. Hani is on the line from Oceanside, California. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do?
I'm a consulting engineer. And I work here in Southern California. We bought a house about 5 years ago. We have a jumbo mortgage, and we're getting really close to the difference between the jumbo and a conventional.
Ah, $417,000 would be that cutoff.
Right. We are at $429,000. The question is, would it be a feasible thing at this time to pay the difference and refinance, get a conventional mortgage? My interest rate now is at 7.53.
Is that an adjustable rate mortgage?
Yes, it is, and it adjusts once a year.
Well, Chris, this is a question that's coming up now a lot because of the Fed's rate cut last week.
Yes. Let's just do a couple of quick definitions. As you mentioned, conventional mortgage, that's under $417,000. A jumbo is above that. And so right now, Tess, the difference between a jumbo and a conventional is about a percentage point.
In terms of the interest rate that you're going to get.
Of the interest rate. So it's about 6%, a little bit above 6% for a conventional, and it's about 7% or around 7% for a jumbo.
Okay. When's your next adjustment, Hani?
They send us a letter at about October.
Okay.
And it takes effect, I think, in January.
So, Chris, right now his loan is at 7.53. It's going to potentially adjust in, well, next month. What's his best option at this point?
Okay. Most people who have a one-year adjustable rate mortgage are breathing a little bit of a sigh of relief with the October reset because at least their rate won't go up very much.
Mm-hmm.
But my primary concern is having an adjustable rate mortgage. And I think, you know, it's a pretty good idea to shift into a fixed rate, have that certainty, and then refinance if rates do go back down later on.
Would it be wise for them to pay off that $12,000 so that they can get a conforming loan?
If there's a percentage point difference and this is a long-term investment, that is going to compound over time and it can make sense. But I want to throw in a real big caveat that most homeowners today have to think about seriously. How diversified is your portfolio? If you take this money to pay down the mortgage so that it's going to qualify for a cheaper rate, are you taking a big chunk of your savings and putting more of it into your home? Yes, you're getting a cheaper rate. But as you know, Tess, and I am Mr. Diversify, and you know, I think that it's really important that people not put too much of their savings into their home, but build a diversified portfolio elsewhere. If you pay it down, are you putting more and more of your savings into your home?
Right. This is what we are banking on, that the house actually doubled in price. And we are using this as part of our retirement. I don't have a great retirement, you know, saved up. So it is not a good idea then. I'm not as diversified as you would recommend.
Yeah, I can't say that it's a bad move. And I would run the numbers and see what the difference it's going to make over a period of time and, you know, make your judgment from there. But the thing that I really do want to emphasize, and emphasize not just for you, for a lot of our listeners, is the importance of building up that retirement savings plan before they sink more of their money into their home.
Does that help you out, honey?
Yes, it does.
All right. Well, thanks so much for the call.
Well, thank you for talking to me.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag. And Nish writes in from Houston, Texas, and he was listening to our summer school series and heard the piece that we did on credit scores, heard that credit scores range from 350 to 850. 750 and above is considered really good. 650 and below is considered subprime. Well, he recently went to one of the credit scoring sites, and it said that Experian and TransUnion scores range from 501 to 990. Uh-oh. So let's talk a little bit about the differences between the different credit agencies and what kind of number you should really be looking for.
Okay. The classic credit score numbers. We call it your FICO. It's by a company, Fair Isaac, and that's exactly right. You know, 300, you're a deadbeat. 850, you're sterling, and that's the range. Now, you have these credit reporting agencies, Experian, TransUnion, Equifax, and they said, you know, why should we just give this business to Fair Isaac? We're going to come up with our own version of a credit score. They call it the Vantage Score. They want to move into the business. I have to tell you, by the way, it hasn't taken on like wildfire. FICO still dominates it, but there is the possibility that you could get a credit score between 501 and 990. But essentially, the methodology is the same. And what is the methodology dominated by? Do you pay your bills on time? And how long is your credit history?
All right. Are you a loyal listener who's still a little confused with something we aired? Give us a call. It's our job to make sure you understand everything. Click on the contact button on our website, marketplace.org, or call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. All right, caller number two is with us. Michael is in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
What do you do there in Jacksonville?
I'm in the U.S. Navy.
Interesting. How long have you been doing that?
19 years.
Wow. And what do you do in the Navy?
I am an EOD technician. I disarm bombs. I make things go away.
You disarm bombs?
Yes, ma'am.
That's one dangerous job.
Yeah, it's not as bad as you think. I mean, if you do it right, it's safe.
Well, a lot of us have been hearing the phrase IED since the start of the Iraq War. Have you been over there?
Yes, ma'am. I was over there with my team in early 2003. Our team disarmed 30 IEDs. I personally was P1, which is the guy downrange for six of them.
Wow. How, I just out of curiosity, how do you train for something like that? Because most of us, when we train for our jobs, we make mistakes along the way. You can't make a mistake.
Well, the motto is initial success or total failure. Most of it is knowing how things work. Everybody's a little different. I mean, me, whenever I would go down ranges, I would think to myself, I'm smarter than they are, I'm better trained, and they can't get me. I just would do my procedures the way that it needed to be done. A lot of the stuff's done remotely using a robot and whatnot, but sometimes you have to do what you got to do.
Well, on behalf of all of us, thank you so much for your service.
Thank you.
It really is so incredibly admirable. So what is your question for Chris today?
Basically, because I'm staying in, they're going to give me some money. It's like 80 grand. What should I do with it? I'm going to get half of it up front, taxed, and then the other 40 grand will be given to me in installments over the number of years that I reenlisted for. I have a second mortgage. Should I pay off my second mortgage, or should I invest it and then just keep paying normal payments on my second and pay it off when I sell my house?
Tell us a little bit about your family situation, Michael.
I've got three kids, 10, 6, and 2. My wife is not working. She's in school right now, which is the reason we have the second, paying for all her school and everything like that.
So what kind of plans have you already made in terms of saving for your kids' education and also for your own retirement?
My retirement, the basics of it, I'll be getting about anywhere between $1,500 and $2,000 a month in retirement pay. You know, my medical will be basically covered at a $400 a year deductible. As far as saving for school, I haven't really started at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Chris, this is a good chunk of money. What's your advice?
You know, my initial reaction is, boy, I'd pay off a big chunk, at least with the initial $40,000, pay off a big chunk of the second mortgage. And then, you know, put aside a chunk of it for savings that can be tapped into very easily and you wouldn't have to borrow. That's the most conservative advice I can give you. It's very conservative advice. You can't go wrong. Another idea to toss in there, which is not it's not an either or, but is for your children to seed a 529 college savings plan for them.
529?
A 529. The advantage of a 529 college savings plan, and every state offers them, is that you can set aside some of this money and it will grow while they're getting older. And when you withdraw the money to pay for college, it's tax-free.
Would I have to do it in the state that I am in? Because right now I'm in Florida, but I'm transferring to Virginia.
Doesn't matter what state you're in. Doesn't matter where your children go to college. Doesn't matter whether they go to public or private school. And I don't think people should put too much of their money into one of these plans, but it's really a wonderful way to relieve some of the financial pressure when your children are older and they want to go to college. And you want to say to them, look, I want you to go to college that you really want to go to. But a lot of times there's some financial pressure and that doesn't work out. This relieves some of that financial pressure.
Okay.
And also, I just wanted to add with the 529 plans, there's a website called savingforcollege.com. And it really has a lot of good information about 529 plans if you want to investigate that option.
I definitely do. And I make sure the kids are hooked up. So thank you.
You stay safe over there, all right?
Always do that.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Hey, you know, if any of you have some advice for Michael on what he should be doing with this bonus from Uncle Sam, we've heard from Chris. Let's hear from you. Write us with your suggestions, and maybe we'll forward those to him and even get those on the air. Well, if you've got a financial plan you need a second opinion on, think of us as a trusted advisor. Click on the contact button on our website. It's marketplace.org, or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right, Chris, one more reach into the email bag, and Gwyneth writes in from St. Paul, Minnesota, right your neck of the woods. And in 10 years, her first child is going to be heading off to college. So she's planning ahead. And Series Double E savings bonds seem like a pretty good investment to her, but she's a little confused by the income limits. She is below the income limits listed for 2006, but of course, they don't know what their income will be in 10 years when they'll be redeeming the bonds to cover tuition, et cetera. So how does this work? Are they just supposed to kind of roll the dice, hope for the best?
You know, I love Series EE savings bonds. I think they're terrific. Problem is, the government's made it complicated. As you mentioned, one of the things is the phase-outs or the income limits. And for 2007, single filer, you know, just rounding off the numbers, starts phasing out a little over $65,000. If you're a joint filer, you know, the income limit is pretty generous, $98,000 to $128,000, you know, rounding off the numbers. Nevertheless, you have to worry about this issue.
So what do they mean by these income limits? Is that an income limit in terms of when you're able to buy these bonds, or does that income limit also apply to when you cash them in?
No, it's only when you cash them in. So you could be making $1 million a year when you buy them, and it doesn't matter. It's when you cash them in that the income limits, the phase outs, kick in and they matter.
And so what happens if you've bought the bond and then you try to cash it out later, but you exceed the limits? What happens to the bond?
Well, it's not the end of the world. It's just that you are going to have to pay taxes on the interest, which is why people are turning to 529 plans.
All right, so here we are again with the 529. So should Gwyneth not be using this double E and go ahead and go with the 529?
I would. By the way, I have my own portfolio. I have Series EE and Series I bonds. Like I say, I like them. I think it's a good part of her portfolio. I'm going to end up paying taxes on it when I cash them in. So I don't think she's done anything wrong here. It's a perfectly good investment. But in terms of saving for college, in today's world, what's far more sensible is the 529 route.
All right. Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take for this week's program. But do leave your question for a future show on our voicemail. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or visit our website. We're at marketplace.org and click on the contact button there. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up, sometimes selling a home requires a bit of gold dust, Hollywood style.
It's like a movie set. You're capturing a moment in time that's idealized.
But a professional makeover of your decor can cost big bucks. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Trying to sell your house? Good luck with that. The Commerce Department said this week that sales of new homes hit a 7-year low in August. Ouch. But if you do have to sell, somebody will probably suggest that you stage your home. If you've ever looked through a home furnishing catalog and thought, oh man, I'd like to live there, well, that's how stagers work. Kurt Nickish of WBUR in Boston got a firsthand view.
I rented a house and even helped my landlord sell it out from under me. Call me crazy. I let them move in furniture and decorate it to go on the market while I was still living there. In came Daisy Riley, home stager extraordinaire. She set out candles as big as fire hydrants. Bundles of willows leaned fashionably in corners. African bowls hung in the kitchen like red peppers. Overnight, I was living in a Pottery Barn showroom. Daisy knew what I was feeling.
Whoa. Yeah. This is not my house.
She's familiar with the reaction. It's not the first time she's had to transform a bachelor pad.
A single man, definitely. You know. Very sparse furnishings usually. Maybe one or two nice pieces a girlfriend gave them or the parents gave them. But, you know, mostly it's utilitarian.
Great, Daisy. Thanks for shattering my public radio mystique. But the point is, while utilitarian might be good for living in a house, it's deadly for showing one.
It's like a movie set. You're capturing a moment in time that's idealized.
The way she did that in my place was by carting to the basement everything that wasn't
pretty
or
sparkly
or
fluffy.
Basically, my whole living room.
There were a lot of paperbacks and a lot of not necessarily pretty on the outside books. Content-wise, I'm sure they were very nice, but for something like this, you want attractively covered books.
In their place, she sprinkled a handful of hardcovers, one on antiques, one on mythology. The one on feng shui matched the terracotta Buddha she perched on the fireplace mantle.
So I'm curious, which Buddha is that, do you know?
I don't.
Not important.
We're not necessarily looking for serious Buddhists.
Just people who like to think of themselves as spiritual. Now, there is skill behind all this semblance. Daisy crafted the living room with low-slung couches that made it seem bigger. It cost $3,500, and it all paid off. The real estate agent, Hannah Abrams, says she was able to list the house for more because it was staged.
I thought the difference between not staging and staging for this property would be about $20,000. But because the staging was so great, I think they're more likely to net an additional $30,000.
What's more, the house sold in just 10 days, and for about what she thought they'd net.
I didn't think it's been staged.
That's Ed Perlmutter. He's the one buying the house.
It felt neat and tidy and organized and all of the things that I want to be. Maybe if I lived there, I could be like that. I mean, I think, again, at some level, I did think that.
Ed was so taken with it, he hired Daisy to stage his old house, the one he's moving out of.
Hi. Hello, Daisy. Yes.
Hello, Daisy.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Welcome to the mess.
Thank you.
I went along when Daisy checked out Ed's house. As they stepped over half-packed boxes and cans of paint, I got an appreciation for the chaos and cellar stress that Daisy has to turn into a soothing catalog scene.
How do we feel about this bright yellow?
The bright yellow was just painted, Daisy, and it's not going anywhere.
Okay.
It was a color choice that was made that is, we're here. We're here with the yellow.
All right. Well, mm-hmm. We'll work with the yellow then.
And Daisy did. Ed paid her $1,500 for her services and to rent furniture and tchotchkes. The place sold within a week.
It was looking pretty shiny. The staging absolutely helped sell it so quickly. There is no doubt in my mind.
It cost him. And don't forget, he's paying a lot more for the new house he bought, the one I was renting, because it was staged. But it doesn't bother Ed. Look, in this market, if paying a pro to decorate sells houses, he's all for it.
It's why you have your hair cut by a barber. And you don't, you know, put a bowl over your head and cut your own hair.
One more thing, Ed felt so inferior for living such an unpretty, unsparkly, unfluffy life, he's now hiring Daisy again to help decorate his new house. He wants his real life to approach the idealized life he paid for. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace Money.
And to see photos of Ed's new home when it was staged for sale, go to our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over a billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
No doubt this week's deal between General Motors and the UAW will have a lasting effect on the debate over health insurance. GM will no longer be responsible for providing coverage and setting benefits for its retirees. An independent trust will do that. And analysts are warning that more and more of us will face retirement with no help from corporate America. Many older Americans are deciding that as they develop health problems, instead of moving into a facility, they'll have a medical aide come to them. We wanted to know what that might entail, so Eleanor Ginsler of the AARP is here. Eleanor, what are the most important considerations in hiring a home health care worker?
There are a couple of different approaches that people can take when they need home care. One is to identify where the home care agencies are in your community. Another route to go that some people find very satisfying, they use their own social networks. A good example of that might be a church that they attend, and they work with people in that church to find out who do they know that does this kind of work regularly and that they would hire independently to be of assistance to somebody who needs that care in the house.
Is there any way to estimate the cost of home health care like this? Or I suppose it really must depend on what the situation is and how much care you need.
You know, that's exactly the point. You could just need a couple of hours a day of somebody that is a personal care assistant that's helping you with things like bathing and dressing. Then you actually also have to figure out, do I need both a personal care assistant and a regular visit, perhaps by a registered nurse or a licensed practical nurse? You get into the nursing range, and then you're going to be paying more on an hourly basis for that service.
Let's talk about how to search for a home caregiver. What are the top three questions that you should ask when you're, I guess, interviewing someone?
You know, it is an interview. And if you're going the agency route, you're actually going to hopefully do multiple interviews. AARP thinks you should interview the agency. And when you talk to that agency, you want to ask them, how many staff do they have? What kinds of staff do they have? What are the training requirements that they insist take place before they'll hire a person to work for them? And what's the ongoing training that they offer to their staff so that you can be sure there's quality improvement going on at all times? You also want to ask that agency about such things as, do they have 24-hour service? When you are talking to the individual care provider themselves, you want to actually ask them, why do they do this kind of work? How long have they done this kind of work? What do they find the most satisfying about this work? And whether you're talking to an individual or an agency, you absolutely want to ask for references.
Is this the kind of service where you can use insurance to pay for it? Does it also qualify for Medicare, Medicaid reimbursements?
That is a really good point to ask. It is going to depend upon your specific circumstance. For example, if you are coming out of the hospital and have had some treatment in the hospital that requires some additional follow-up treatment, that's going to be a situation that very likely would be covered by Medicare for a short period of time. Medicaid, we know, is the provider of health care insurance for individuals who are lower income.
Mm-hmm.
And it is true that in some communities, that Medicaid program will cover home care. Every state administers Medicaid in their own manner, so you have to be familiar with and learn about your state's Medicaid program to learn what services are provided and what services aren't. If an agency is accepting Medicare or Medicaid reimbursement, that actually means that that agency is being inspected by the federal government and the state government to make sure that they are properly providing care in order to receive that reimbursement from the government.
And what about private insurance? Is that something that is available for home care?
Yeah, the kind of insurance that would probably be available in that case would be long-term care insurance, a fairly new product in the array of insurance products out there, still a very complex product, and many people can't afford it, to be honest. But for those people who have significant resources, the earlier you purchase insurance, the less costly your premiums are going to be. And different long-term care insurance policies cover different types of care. So you want to pick a policy, if you're looking at one, that will absolutely cover home care.
All right. Some great advice on something that a whole lot more people are going to be dealing with in the coming years. Eleanor Ginsler is Director of Livable Communities for the AARP. Thanks so much for coming in.
It's been a pleasure.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
White House officials say the president
and the experts say usually
the Heritage Foundation estimates
like it's going to be the best quarter.
They decide what they're going to
charge. That has some veterans nervous.
It's time once again for our economics editor, Chris Farrell, to help you sort out what's smart, what's stupid, and what's the straight story. And Chris, you're calm.
Yeah.
You're rational.
Absolutely.
But I hear you're threatening to lose your cool to make some moolah. Are you going to pull a Jim Cramer on us?
No, I'm not going to smash the computer in the studio or anything, but... Oh, all right.
Oh, my word. And the award for best use of sound effects goes to Mr. Chris Farrell.
Thank you. Now that I have your attention, I do want to make a point about emotions. Or really, passion is the better word.
Whoa. Dude, this is a personal finance show.
I'm well aware of that, and I think you'll find out that this is an appropriate topic. Now, look, we've all been taught in recent years that emotions are bad for investment health. Instead of being rational and analytical, we get scared or greedy or overconfident and make money mistakes.
Yep.
Yet according to recent research, hot-headed investors make better financial decisions. In fact, the greater the emotional intensity test, the higher the paycheck. So here's the straight story. Emotions are not the enemy of reason or stock returns. No, what really matters when it comes to making money is that old adage that I love, know thyself.
Just a minute here.
Okay.
Whenever we go through a crash in the market like we had this past summer, you always counsel patience. You know, take a step back, take it easy. Everything's going to be okay. We're in for the long term. So
yeah,
what are you
right.
talking about here with making lots of money by getting all hot and bothered?
I actually think that there is a consistency to my approach. Here's how I divide the world test, and here's how I answer your question. There are those who live, breathe, they're passionate about the markets. They want to know what's going on in the markets. They can tap this emotional intelligence that over the years they've learned when things are going bad, things are going good. They can analyze their emotions. They can harness those emotions and turn them into a profit. But most of us, most of our passion and our work goes into what we do in our job, our families. All these things take time. And therefore, we don't have the passion when it comes to the market. We don't have a lot of emotional intelligence. So we do tend to make mistakes. And that's why you want to do things like buy an insurance policy, invest for the long haul. So I really think we need to divide the investment universe and be honest. Which side of this divide are you on?
Well, I would say I'm on the chill side of the divide.
And I'm absolutely on the chill. You know, look, when I invest, it's not to try and match my wits with Warren Buffett. I'm just trying to take some of my money today.
Right.
And I want my children to go to college and not to be working off their debt for the rest of their life. I'd like to have a nice standard of living in retirement. And that's a very different goal.
But, you know, we talk a lot about this notion of behavioral economics. And in fact, we did an interview last week with Jason Zweig, who did this book called Your Money and Your Brain.
A good book.
And
I like it.
The argument is that you cannot be emotional. Tell me, where is the proof that actually having greater emotion about it is going to pay off in the stock market?
There's a theoretical debate that's going on right now in the world of personal finance, as reflected in Jason Zweig's book about the intelligence of our emotions. And Andrew Lowe, one of my favorite economists at MIT, he's also a hedge fund manager. He took traders and wired their brain and monitored them while they were trading. That's where he talked about gut instinct, this emotional intelligence that the really good traders have. What the behavioral finance people are talking about is the people who, you know, we find I have a neighbor and, God, this neighbor's been doing well in the market and they bought this stock and they told me to buy this stock and maybe I should do that. So they're really addressing their story to you, the average person.
So your advice to us, if we're long-term investors and we don't really pay a whole lot of attention to our stocks and our bonds, we can go ahead and chill out. But, you know, if you're really in there and you're paying attention, then you can go ahead and be a hothead?
Yes. If you're like you and me, Tess, behavioral finance is our Bible. We can learn a lot from it. We will profit by it. If you are an engaged investor and this is something you want to dominate your life, you need to know the lessons of behavioral finance, but then go way beyond it.
All right. The straight story from our man, Chris Farrell. Chris, thanks as always for keeping a cool head with us.
And thanks a lot, Tess.
What's the scariest month of the year? Why, October, of course. The month of ghouls and goblins is upon us. But according to Wall Street lore, September is the month of horror. So superstitious investors who believe in bad September might be breathing easier now that it's over. But what if it's not the worst month? What if it gets even worse? David Weiss is chief economist for Standard & Poor's and not the superstitious type. David, when should we be afraid? Very afraid.
October is the month that always has the big crashes in it.
But actually, on average, September does worse, and Halloween just isn't as scary as it used to be.
Okay, so what's going on with September?
I don't know. There's a couple of theories. One is that people come back from summer vacation, suddenly throw up their hands in horror and start selling everything they can find in order to get back into shape after not doing anything for 2 months. Another theory is fund managers, if they made gains for the year, like to lock in those gains by the end of the third quarter, thus guaranteeing their annual bonus and allowing them to coast through the fourth quarter.
Ah, the all-important bonus.
Hey, that's why they're in the business.
Right. That's why I should be in the business. Well, but what about this September? I don't think this is following the trend, is it?
No, this September has been better. We sort of had the September drop in August, so
right.
I don't know what that proves. The stock market, though, in August was reacting to the freeze-up that we saw in short-term financial markets.
The credit crunch.
The credit crunch. And now they're seeing things coming back sort of to normal. They're not going back to where they were a few months ago, but things are improving a bit. And the stock market is coming back sort of ahead of schedule.
So any predictions for October as we head into it?
Well, I think October is going to be quiet. I don't see a lot of gains possible. But on the other hand, neither do I see any big losses. And I think we'll get the usual end of year rally in December.
Santa Claus will arrive?
Santa Claus will arrive. I will say there's been a tendency over time for these months to gradually rotate. We used to talk about a January rally. Now it's a December rally. I sometimes wonder whether the bad September is turning into a bad August.
David Weiss is chief economist at Standard & Poor's. Thanks for going through this with us.
Thank you.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, shopping online with your personal sales avatar.
Mostly it adds personality to the website, and I think that people can connect to that.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Rico Galliano, James Richter, Stephen Hoffman, Michelle Philippi, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yorp. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.